production, consequently with the accumulation that accompanies the development of its productive power, labour keeps up and eternizes an always increasing capital value in a form ever new. This natural power of labour takes the appearance of an intrinsic property of capital in which it is incorporated, just as the productive forces of social labour take the appearance of inherent properties of capital, and as the constant appropriation of surplus labour by the capitalists takes that of a constant self-expansion of capital. Footnote. Classic economy has, on account of a deficient analysis of the labour process and of the process of creating value, never properly grasped this weighty element of reproduction, as may be seen in Ricardo. He says, for example, whatever the change in productive power, 1 million men always produce in manufactures the same value. This is accurate, if the extension and degree of intensity of their labour are given. But it does not prevent, this Ricardo overlooks in certain conclusions he draws, 1 million men, with different powers of productivity in their labour, turning into products very different masses of the means of production, and therefore preserving in their products very different masses of value. In consequence of which, the values of the products yielded may vary considerably. Ricardo has, it may be noted in passing, tried in vain to make clear to J.B. Say, by that very example, the difference between use value, which he here calls wealth or material riches, and exchange value. Say answers, as for the difficulty raised by Ricardo when he says that by using better methods of production, 1 million people can produce 2 or 3 times as much wealth without producing any more value, this difficulty disappears when one bears in mind, as one should, that production is like an exchange in which a man contributes the productive services of his labour, his land, and his capital in order to obtain products. It is by means of these productive services that we acquire all the products existing in the world. Therefore, we are richer, our productive services have the more value, the greater the quantity of useful things they bring in through the exchange which is called production. J.B. Say, Lettre à Monsieur Malthus, Paris, 1820. The difficulté, it exists for him, not for Ricardo, that Say means to clear up, is this. Why does not the exchange value of the use values increase when their quantity increases in consequence of increased productive power of labour? Answer, the difficulty is met by calling use value exchange value, if you please. Exchange value is a thing that is connected one way or another with exchange. If, therefore, production is called an exchange of labour and means of production against a product, it is clear as day that you obtain more exchange value in proportion as the production yields more use value. In other words, the more use values, for example, stockings, a working day yields to the stocking manufacturer, the richer he is in stockings. Suddenly, however, Say recollects that, with a greater quantity of stockings, their price, which of course has nothing to do with their exchange value, falls because competition obliges them, the producers, to sell their products for what they cost to make. But whence does the profit come, if the capitalist sells the commodities at cost price? Never mind. Say declares that, in consequence of increased productivity, everyone now receives in return for a given equivalent 2 pairs of stockings instead of 1 as before. The result he arrives at is precisely that proposition of Ricardo that he aimed at disproving. After this mighty effort of thought, he triumphantly apostrophizes Malthus in the words, "This, sir, is the well-founded doctrine without which it is impossible, I say, to explain the greatest difficulties in political economy, and, in particular, to explain why it is that a nation can be richer when its products fall in value, even though wealth is value." An English economist remarks upon the conjuring tricks of the same nature that appear in Say's Lettres. "Those affected ways of talking make up in general that which Monsieur Say is pleased to call his doctrine, and which he earnestly urges Malthus to teach at Hartford, as it is already taught in numerous parts of Europe. He says, if all those propositions appear paradoxical to you, look at the things they express, and I venture to believe that they will then appear very simple and very rational." Doubtless, and in consequence of the same process, they will appear everything else except original. An inquiry into those principles respecting the nature of demand, etc. End of footnote. With the increase of capital, the difference between the capital employed and the capital consumed increases. In other words, there is increase in the value and the material mass of the instruments of labour, such as buildings, machinery, drain pipes, working cattle, apparatus of every kind that function for a longer or shorter time in processes of production constantly repeated, or that serve for the attainment of particular useful effects, whilst they themselves only gradually wear out, therefore only lose their value piecemeal, therefore transfer that value to the product only bit by bit. In the same proportion as these instruments of labour serve as product formers without adding value to the product, that is, in the same proportion as they are wholly employed but only partly consumed, they perform, as we saw earlier, the same gratuitous service as the natural forces, water, steam, air, electricity, etc. This gratuitous service of past labour, when seized and filled with a soul by living labour, increases with the advancing stages of accumulation. Since past labour always disguises itself as capital, that is, since the passive of the labour of A, B, C, etc. takes the form of the active of the non-labourer X, bourgeois and political economists are full of praises of the services of dead and gone labour, which, according to the Scotch genius McCulloch, ought to receive a special remuneration in the shape of interest, profit, etc. Footnote. McCulloch took out a patent for wages of past labour, long before Senior did for wages of abstinence. End of footnote. The powerful and ever-increasing assistance given by past labour to the living labour process under the form of means of production is, therefore, attributed to that form of past labour in which it is alienated as unpaid labour from the worker himself, that is, to its capitalistic form. The practical agents of capitalistic production and their pettifogging ideologists are as unable to think of the means of production as separate from the antagonistic social mask they wear today as a slave owner to think of the worker himself as distinct from his character as a slave. With a given degree of exploitation of labour power, the mass of the surplus value produced is determined by the number of workers simultaneously exploited. And this corresponds, although in varying proportions, with the magnitude of the capital. The more, therefore, capital increases by means of successive accumulations, the more does the sum of the value increase that is divided into consumption fund and accumulation fund. The capitalist can, therefore, live a more jolly life, and at the same time show more abstinence. And finally, all the springs of production act with greater elasticity, the more its scale extends with the mass of the capital advanced. Section 5. The so-called Labour Fund. It has been shown in the course of this inquiry that capital is not a fixed magnitude, but is a part of social wealth, elastic and constantly fluctuating with the division of fresh surplus value into revenue and additional capital. It has been seen further that even with a given magnitude of functioning capital, the labour power, the science, and the land, by which are to be understood economically all conditions of labour furnished by nature independently of man, embodied in it, form elastic powers of capital, allowing it, within certain limits, a field of action independent of its own magnitude. In this inquiry, we have neglected all effects of the process of circulation, effects which may produce very different degrees of efficiency in the same mass of capital. And as we presupposed the limits set by capitalist production, that is to say, presupposed the process of social production in a form developed by purely spontaneous growth, we neglected any more rational combination, directly and systematically practicable, with the means of production and the mass of labour at present disposable. Classical economy always loved to conceive social capital as a fixed magnitude of a fixed degree of efficiency. But this prejudice was first established as a dogma by the arch-Philistine Jeremy Bentham, that insipid, pedantic, leather-tongued oracle of the ordinary bourgeois intelligence of the 19th century. Footnote. Compare, among others, Jeremy Bentham, Théorie des peines et des récompenses. End of footnote. Bentham is among philosophers what Martin Tupper is among poets. Both could only have been manufactured in England. Footnote. Bentham is a purely English phenomenon, not even excepting our philosopher Christian Wolfe. In no time and in no country has the most homespun commonplace ever strutted about in so self-satisfied a way. The principle of utility was no discovery of Bentham. He simply reproduced in his dull way what Helvetius and other Frenchmen had said with esprit in the 18th century. To know what is useful for a dog, one must study dog nature. This nature itself is not to be deduced from the principle of utility. Applying this to man, he that would criticize all human acts, movements, relations, etc., by the principle of utility, must first deal with human nature in general, and then with human nature as modified in each historical epoch. Bentham makes short work of it. With the driest naivete, he takes the modern shopkeeper, especially the English shopkeeper, as the normal man. Whatever is useful to this queer normal man and to his world is absolutely useful. This yard measure, then, he applies to past, present, and future. The Christian religion, for example, is useful, because it forbids in the name of religion the same faults that the penal code condemns in the name of the law. Artistic criticism is harmful, because it disturbs worthy people in their enjoyment of Martin Tupper, etc. With such rubbish has the brave fellow, with his motto, Nuila dies sine line, piled up mountains of books. Had I the courage of my friend Heinrich Heine, I should call Mr. Jeremy a genius in the way of bourgeois stupidity. End of footnote. In the light of his dogma, the communist phenomena of the process of production, as, for example, its sudden expansions and contractions, nay, even accumulation itself, become perfectly inconceivable. Footnote. Political economists are too apt to consider a certain quantity of capital and a certain number of labourers as productive instruments of uniform power, or operating with a certain uniform intensity, Those who maintain that commodities are the sole agents of production prove that production could never be enlarged, for it requires as an indispensable condition to such enlargement that food, raw materials, and tools should be previously augmented, which is in fact maintaining that no increase of production can take place without a previous increase, or in other words, that an increase is impossible. S. Bailey, Money and Its Vicissitudes. Bailey criticizes the dogma mainly from the point of view of the process of circulation. End of footnote. The dogma was used by Bentham himself, as well as by Malthus, James Mill, McCulloch, etc., for an apologetic purpose, and especially in order to represent one part of capital, namely variable capital, or that part convertible into labour power, as a fixed magnitude. The material of variable capital, that is, the mass of the means of subsistence it represents for the labourer, or the so-called labour fund, was fabled as a separate part of social wealth, fixed by natural laws and unchangeable. To set in motion the part of social wealth which is to function as constant capital, or to express it in a material form as a means of production, a definite mass of living labour is required. This mass is given technologically. But neither is the number of labourers required to render fluid this mass of labour power a given. It changes with the degree of exploitation of the individual labour power. Nor is the price of this labour power given, but only its minimum limit, which is, moreover, very variable. The facts that lie at the bottom of this dogma are these. On the one hand, the labourer has no right to interfere in the division of social wealth into means of enjoyment for the non-labourer and means of production. On the other hand, only in favourable and exceptional cases has he the power to enlarge the so-called labour fund at the expense of the revenue of the wealthy. Footnote. John Stuart Mill, in his Principles of Political Economy, says, "The really exhausting and the really repulsive labours, instead of being better paid than others, are almost invariably paid the worst of all. The more revolting the occupation, the more certain it is to receive the minimum of remuneration. The hardships and the earnings, instead of being directly proportional, as in any just arrangements of society they would be, are generally in an inverse ratio to one another." To avoid misunderstanding, let me say that although men like John Stuart Mill are to blame for the contradiction between their traditional economic dogmas and their modern tendencies, it would be very wrong to class them with the herd of vulgar economic apologists. End of footnote. What silly tautology results from the attempt to represent the capitalistic limits of the labour fund as its natural and social limits may be seen, for example, in Professor Fawcett. Footnote. H. Fawcett, Professor of Political Economy at Cambridge. The Economic Position of the British Labourer. London, 1865. End of footnote. "The circulating capital of a country," he says, "is its wage fund. Hence, if we desire to calculate the average money wages received by each labourer, we have simply to divide the amount of this capital by the number of the labouring population." Footnote. I must here remind the reader that the categories variable and constant capital were first used by me. Political economy, since the time of Adam Smith, has confusedly mixed up the essential distinctions involved in these categories, with the mere formal differences arising out of the process of circulation of fixed and circulating capital. For further details on this point, see Book 2, Part 2. End of footnote. That is to say, we first add together the individual wages actually paid, and then we affirm that the sum thus obtained forms the total value of the labour fund, determined and vouchsafed to us by God and nature. Lastly, we divide the sum thus obtained by the number of labourers, to find out again how much may come to each on the average. An uncommonly knowing dodge, this. It did not prevent Mr. Fawcett saying in the same breath, "The aggregate wealth which is annually saved in England is divided into two portions. One portion is employed as capital to maintain our industry, and the other portion is exported to foreign countries. Only a portion, and perhaps not a large portion, of the wealth which is annually saved in this country is invested in our own industry. The greater part of the yearly accruing surplus product embezzled, because abstracted without return of an equivalent, from the English labourer, is thus used as capital not in England, but in foreign countries. But, with the additional capital thus exported, a part of the labour fund, invented by God and Bentham, is also exported." Footnote. It might be said that not only capital, but also labourers, in the shape of emigrants, are annually exported from England. In the text, however, there is no question of the peculium of the emigrants, who are in great part not labourers. The sons of farmers make up a great part of them. The additional capital annually transported abroad to be put out at interest is in much greater proportion to the annual accumulation than the yearly emigration is to the yearly increase of population. End of footnote. Chapter 25. The General Law of Capitalist Accumulation. Section 1. The increased demand for labour power that accompanies accumulation. The composition of capital remaining the same. In this chapter, we consider the influence of the growth of capital on the lot of the labouring class. The most important factor in this inquiry is the composition of capital, and the changes it undergoes in the course of the process of accumulation. The composition of capital is to be understood in a twofold sense. On the side of value, it is determined by the proportion in which it is divided into constant capital, or value of the means of production, and variable capital, or value of labour power, the sum total of wages. On the side of material, as it functions in the process of production, all capital is divided into means of production and living labour power. This latter composition is determined by the relation between the mass of the means of production employed on the one hand, and the mass of labour necessary for their employment on the other. I call the former the value composition, the latter the technical composition of capital. Between the two there is a strict correlation. To express this, I call the value composition of capital, insofar as it is determined by its technical composition and mirrors the changes of the latter, the organic composition of capital. Wherever I refer to the composition of capital without further qualification, its organic composition is always understood. The many individual capitals invested in a particular branch of production have, one with another, more or less different compositions. The average of their individual compositions gives us the composition of the total capital in this branch of production. Lastly, the average of these averages, in all branches of production, gives us the composition of the total social capital of a country, and with this alone are we, in the last resort, concerned in the following investigation. Growth of capital involves growth of its variable constituent, or of the part invested in labour power. A part of the surplus value turned into additional capital must always be retransformed into variable capital, or additional labour fund. If we suppose that, all other circumstances remaining the same, the composition of capital also remains constant, that is, that a definite mass of means of production constantly needs the same mass of labour power to set it in motion, then the demand for labour and the subsistence fund of the labourers clearly increase in the same proportion as the capital. And the more rapidly the capital increases. Since the capital produces yearly a surplus value, of which one part is yearly added to the original capital, since this increment itself grows yearly along with the augmentation of the capital already functioning, since, lastly, under special stimulus to enrichment, such as the opening of new markets or of new spheres for the outlay of capital in consequence of newly developed social wants, etc., the scale of accumulation may be suddenly extended, merely by a change in the division of the surplus value or surplus product into capital and revenue. The requirements of accumulating capital may exceed the increase of labour power or of the number of labourers. The demand for labourers may exceed the supply, and therefore wages may rise. This must, indeed, ultimately be the case if the conditions supposed continue. For since in each year more labourers are employed than in its predecessor, sooner or later a point must be reached at which the requirements of accumulation begin to surpass the customary supply of labour, and, therefore, a rise of wages takes place. A lamentation on this score was heard in England during the whole of the 15th and the first half of the 18th centuries. The more or less favourable circumstances in which the wage working class supports and multiplies itself in no way alter the fundamental character of capitalist production. As simple reproduction constantly reproduces the capital relation itself, that is, the relation of capitalists on the one hand and wage workers on the other, so reproduction on a progressive scale, that is, accumulation, reproduces the capital relation on a progressive scale. More capitalists or larger capitalists at this pole, more wage workers at that. The reproduction of a mass of labour power, which must incessantly reincorporate itself with capital for that capital's self-expansion, which cannot get free from capital, and whose enslavement to capital is only concealed by the variety of individual capitalists to whom it sells itself, this reproduction of labour power forms, in fact, an essential of the reproduction of capital itself. Accumulation of capital is, therefore, increase of the proletariat. Footnote. Karl Marx. À égalité d'oppression des masses, plus un pays a de prolétaires, et plus il est riche. Collins. L'économie politique, source de révolution et des utopies. Prétendu socialiste. Paris, 1857. Our proletarian is economically none other than the wage labourer, who produces and increases capital, and is thrown out on the streets as soon as he is superfluous for the needs of aggrandissement of Monsieur Capital, as Pequeur calls this person. The sickly proletarian of the primitive forest is a pretty Rocherian fancy. The primitive forester is owner of the primitive forest, and uses the primitive forest as his property with the freedom of an orangutan. He is not, therefore, a proletarian. This would only be the case if the primitive forest exploited him instead of being exploited by him. As far as his health is concerned, such a man would well bear comparison not only with the modern proletarian, but also with the syphilitic and scrofulous upper classes. But no doubt Herr Wilhelm Roche by primitive forest means his native heath of Lüneburg. End of footnote. Classical economy grasped this fact so thoroughly that Adam Smith, Ricardo, etc., as mentioned earlier, inaccurately identified accumulation with the consumption, by the productive labourers, of all the capitalised part of the surplus product, or with its transformation into additional wage labourers. As early as 1696, John Bellars says, "For if one had 100,000 acres of land, and as many pounds in money, and as many cattle, without a labourer, what would the rich man be but a labourer? And as the labourers make men rich, so the more labourers there will be, the more rich men, the labour of the poor being the mines of the rich." So also Bernard de Mondeville, at the beginning of the 18th century. "It would be easier, where property is well secured, to live without money than without poor. For who would do the work? As they, the poor, ought to be kept from starving, so they should receive nothing worth saving. If here and there one of the lowest class, by uncommon industry and pinching his belly, lifts himself above the condition he was brought up in, nobody ought to hinder him. Nay, it is undeniably the wisest course for every person in the society, and for every private family, to be frugal. But it is the interest of all rich nations that the greatest part of the poor should almost never be idle, and yet continually spend what they get. Those that get their living by their daily labour have nothing to stir them up to be serviceable but their wants, which it is prudence to relieve, but folly to cure. The only thing, then, that can render the labouring man industrious is a moderate quantity of money, for as too little will, according as his temper is, either dispirit or make him desperate, so too much will make him insolent and lazy. From what has been said, it is manifest that in a free nation, where slaves are not allowed of, the surest wealth consists in a multitude of laborious poor, for besides that they are the never-failing nursery of fleets and armies, without them there could be no enjoyment, and no product of any country could be valuable. To make the society, which of course consists of non-workers, happy, and people easier under the meanest circumstances, it is requisite that great numbers of them should be ignorant as well as poor. Knowledge both enlarges and multiplies our desires, and the fewer things a man wishes for, the more easily his necessities may be supplied. Footnote. Bernard de Mondeville, The Fable of the Bees, 5th edition, London and 1728, remarks, "Temperate living and constant employment is the direct road for the poor to rational happiness," by which he most probably means long working days and little means of subsistence, "and to riches and strength for the state," viz., for the landlords, capitalists, and their political dignitaries and agents. An Essay on Trade and Commerce, London, 1770. What Mondeville, an honest, clear-headed man, had not yet seen, is that the mechanism of the process of accumulation itself increases, along with the capital, the mass of labouring poor, that is, the wage labourers, who turn their labour power into an increasing power of self-expansion of the growing capital, and even by doing so must eternize their dependent relation on their own product, as personified in the capitalists. In reference to this relation of dependence, Sir F. M. Eden, in his The State of the Poor, An History of the Labouring Classes in England, says, "The natural produce of our soil is certainly not fully adequate to our subsistence. We can neither be clothed, lodged, nor fed, but in consequence of some previous labour. A portion, at least, of the society must be indefatigably employed. There are others who, though they neither toil nor spin, can yet command the produce of industry, but who owe their exemption from labour solely to civilization and order. They are peculiarly the creatures of civil institutions, which have recognized that individuals may acquire property by various other means besides the exertion of labour. Persons of independent fortune owe their superior advantages by no means to any superior abilities of their own, but almost entirely to the industry of others. It is not the possession of land or of money, but the command of labour, which distinguishes the opulent from the labouring part of the community. This scheme, approved by Eden, would give the people of property sufficient, but by no means too much, influence and authority over those who work for them. And it would place such labourers not in an abject or servile condition, but in such a state of easy and liberal dependence as all who know human nature and its history will allow to be necessary for their own comfort. Footnote. Eden should have asked, whose creatures, then, are the civil institutions? From his standpoint of juridical illusion, he does not regard the law as a product of the material relations of production, but conversely, the relations of production as products of the law. Languet overthrew Montesquieu's illusory esprit des lois with one word. The spirit of laws is property. End of footnote. Sir F. M. Eden, it may be remarked in passing, is the only disciple of Adam Smith during the 18th century that produced any work of importance. Footnote. If the reader reminds me of Malthus, whose essay on population appeared in 1798, I remind him that this work in its first form is nothing more than a schoolboyish, superficial plagiary of Defoe, Sir James Stuart, Townsend, Franklin, Wallace, etc., and does not contain a single sentence thought out by himself. The great sensation this pamphlet caused was due solely to party interest. The French Revolution had found passionate defenders in the United Kingdom. The principle of population, slowly worked out in the 18th century, and then in the midst of a great social crisis, proclaimed with drums and trumpets as the infallible antidote to the teachings of Condorcet, etc., was greeted with jubilance by the English oligarchy as the great destroyer of all hankerings after human development. Malthus, hugely astonished at his success, gave himself to stuffing into his book materials superficially compiled, and adding to it new matter, not discovered, but annexed by him. Note further, although Malthus was a parson of the English state church, he had taken the monastic vow of celibacy, one of the conditions of holding a fellowship in Protestant Cambridge University. Socios collegiorum maritos esse non permittimus, sed statim postquam quis uxorum duxerit socius collegiae desinat esse. Reports of Cambridge University Commission. This circumstance favourably distinguishes Malthus from the other Protestant parsons, who have shuffled off the command enjoining a celibacy of the priesthood, and have taken "be fruitful and multiply" as their special biblical mission in such a degree that they generally contribute to the increase of population to a really unbecoming extent, whilst they preach at the same time to the labourers the principle of population. It is characteristic that the economic fall of man, the Adam's apple, the urgent appetite, the checks which tend to blunt the shafts of Cupid, as Parson Townsend waggishly puts it, that this delicate question was and is monopolized by the reverends of Protestant theology, or rather of the Protestant Church. With the exception of the Venetian monk Ortez, an original and clever writer, most of the population theory teachers are Protestant parsons. For instance, Bruckner, Théorie du système animal, Leyde, 1767, in which the whole subject of the modern population theory is exhausted, and to which the passing quarrel between Quesnay and his pupil, the elder Mirabeau, furnished ideas on the same topic. Then Parson Wallace, Parson Townsend, Parson Malthus, and his pupil, the Archparson Thomas Chalmers, to say nothing of lesser reverend scribblers in this line. Originally, political economy was studied by philosophers like Hobbes, Locke, Hume, by businessmen and statesmen like Thomas More, Temple, Sully, DeWitt, North, Law, Vanderlint, Cantillon, Franklin, and especially, and with the greatest success, by medical men like Petty, Barbon, Mandeville, Quesnay. Even in the middle of the 18th century, the Reverend Mr. Tucker, a notable economist of his time, excused himself for meddling with the things of mammon. Later on, and in truth with this very principle of population, struck the hour of the Protestant parsons. Petty, who regarded the population as the basis of wealth, and was, like Adam Smith, an outspoken foe to parsons, says, as if he had a presentiment of their bungling interference, that religion best flourishes when the priests are most mortified, as was before said of the law, which best flourisheth when lawyers have least to do. He advises the Protestant priests, therefore, if they, once for all, will not follow the Apostle Paul and mortify themselves by celibacy, not to breed more churchmen than the benefices, as they now stand shared out, will receive. That is to say, if there be places for about 12,000 in England and Wales, it will not be safe to breed up 24,000 ministers, for then the 12,000 which are unprovided for will seek ways how to get themselves a livelihood, which they cannot do more easily than by persuading the people that the 12,000 incumbents do poison or starve their souls and misguide them in their way to heaven. Petty, A Treatise of Taxes and Contributions, London, 1667. Adam Smith's position with the Protestant priesthood of his time is shown by the following. In A Letter to A. Smith, LLD, on the Life, Death, and Philosophy of His Friend David Hume, by One of the People Called Christians, 4th edition, Oxford, 1784. Dr. Horne, Bishop of Norwich, reproves Adam Smith, because in a published letter to Mr. Strawn, he embalmed his friend David Hume because he told the world how Hume amused himself on his deathbed with Lucian and whist, and because he even had the impudence to write of Hume, "I have always considered him, both in his lifetime and since his death, as approaching as nearly to the idea of a perfectly wise and virtuous man as, perhaps, the nature of human frailty will permit." The bishop cries out, in a passion, "Is it right in you, sir, to hold up to our view as perfectly wise and virtuous the character and conduct of one who seems to have been possessed with an incurable antipathy to all that is called religion, and who strained every nerve to explode, suppress, and extirpate the spirit of it among men, that its very name, if he could effect it, might no more be had in remembrance? But let not the lovers of truth be discouraged. Atheism cannot be of long continuance." Adam Smith had the atrocious wickedness to propagate atheism through the land, viz. By his theory of moral sentiments. "Upon the whole, Doctor, your meaning is good, but I think that you will not succeed this time. You would persuade us, by the example of David Hume, Esquire, that atheism is the only cordial for low spirits, and the proper antidote against the fear of death. You may smile over Babylon in ruins, and congratulate the hardened Pharaoh on his overthrow in the Red Sea." One orthodox individual, amongst Adam Smith's college friends, writes after his death, "Smith's well-placed affection for Hume hindered him from being a Christian. When he met with honest men whom he liked, he would believe almost anything they said. Had he been a friend of the worthy, ingenious Horrocks, he would have believed that the moon sometimes disappeared in a clear sky without the interposition of a cloud. He approached to republicanism in his political principles." The Bee, by James Anderson, Edinburgh, 1791-93. Parson Thomas Chalmers has his suspicions as to Adam Smith having invented the category of unproductive labourers solely for the Protestant parsons, in spite of their blessed work in the vineyard of the Lord. End of footnote. Under the conditions of accumulation supposed thus far, which conditions are those most favourable to the labourers, their relation of dependence upon capital takes on a form endurable, or, as Eden says, easy and liberal. Instead of becoming more intensive with the growth of capital, this relation of dependence only becomes more extensive, that is, the sphere of capital's exploitation and rule merely extends with its own dimensions and the number of its subjects. A larger part of their own surplus product, always increasing and continually transformed into additional capital, comes back to them in the shape of means of payment, so that they can extend the circle of their enjoyments, can make some additions to their consumption fund of clothes, furniture, etc., and can lay by small reserve funds of money. But just as little as better clothing, food and treatment, and a larger peculium do away with the exploitation of the slave, so little do they set aside that of the wage worker. A rise in the price of labour, as a consequence of accumulation of capital, only means, in fact, that the length and weight of the golden chain the wage worker has already forged for himself allow of a relaxation of the tension of it. In the controversies on this subject, the chief fact has generally been overlooked, viz., the defining characteristic of capitalistic production. Labour power is sold today not with a view of satisfying by its service or by its product the personal needs of the buyer. His aim is augmentation of his capital, production of commodities containing more labour than he pays for, containing therefore a portion of value that costs him nothing, and that is nevertheless realised when the commodities are sold. Production of surplus value is the absolute law of this mode of production. Labour power is only saleable so far as it preserves the means of production in their capacity of capital, reproduces its own value as capital, and yields in unpaid labour a source of additional capital. Footnote. The limit, however, to the employment of both the operative and the labourer is the same, namely the possibility of the employer realising a profit on the produce of their industry. If the rate of wages is such as to reduce the master's gains below the average profit of capital, he will cease to employ them, or he will only employ them on condition of submission to a reduction of wages. John Wade. End of footnote. The conditions of its sale, whether more or less favourable to the labourer, include therefore the necessity of its constant reselling, and the constantly extended reproduction of all wealth in the shape of capital. Wages, as we have seen, by their very nature, always imply the performance of a certain quantity of unpaid labour on the part of the labourer. Altogether, irrespective of the case of a rise of wages with a falling price of labour, etc., such an increase only means, at best, a quantitative diminution of the unpaid labour that the worker has to supply. This diminution can never reach a point at which it would threaten the system itself. Apart from violent conflicts as to the rate of wages, and Adam Smith has already shown that in such a conflict, taken on the whole, the master is always the master, a rise in the price of labour resulting from accumulation of capital implies the following alternative. Either the price of labour keeps on rising because its rise does not interfere with the progress of accumulation. In this there is nothing wonderful, for, says Adam Smith, after these profits are diminished, stock may not only continue to increase, but to increase much faster than before. A great stock, though with small profits, generally increases faster than a small stock with great profits. In this case, it is evident that a diminution in the unpaid labour in no way interferes with the extension of the domain of capital. Or, on the other hand, a accumulation slackens in consequence of the rise in the price of labour, because the stimulus of gain is blunted. The rate of accumulation lessens, but with its lessening, the primary cause of that lessening vanishes, that is, the disproportion between capital and exploitable labour power. The mechanism of the process of capitalist production removes the very obstacles that it temporarily creates. The price of labour falls again to a level corresponding with the needs of the self-expansion of capital, whether the level be below, the same as, or above, the one which was normal before the rise of wages took place. We see thus. In the first case, it is not the diminished rate, either of the absolute or of the proportional increase in labour power or labouring population, which causes capital to be in excess, but conversely, the excess of capital that makes exploitable labour power insufficient. In the second case, it is not the increased rate, either of the absolute or of the proportional increase in labour power, or labouring population, that makes capital insufficient, but conversely, the relative diminution of capital that causes the exploitable labour power, or rather its price, to be in excess. It is these absolute movements of the accumulation of capital which are reflected as relative movements of the mass of exploitable labour power, and therefore seem produced by the latter's own independent movement. To put it mathematically, the rate of accumulation is the independent, not the dependent, variable. The rate of wages, the dependent, not the independent, variable. Thus, when the industrial cycle is in the phase of crisis, a general fall in the price of commodities is expressed as a rise in the value of money. And in the phase of prosperity, a general rise in the price of commodities as a fall in the value of money. The so-called currency school concludes from this that with high prices too much, with low prices too little money is in circulation. Their ignorance and complete misunderstanding of facts, footnote, C.F. Karl Marx, Zur Kritik der politischen Ökonomie, end of footnote, are worthily paralleled by the economists, who interpret the above phenomena of accumulation by saying that there are now too few, now too many, wage labourers. The law of capitalist production, that is at the bottom of the pretended natural law of population, reduces itself simply to this. The correlation between accumulation of capital and rate of wages is nothing else than the correlation between the unpaid labour transformed into capital and the additional paid labour necessary for the setting in motion of this additional capital. It is therefore in no way a relation between two magnitudes independent one of the other. On the one hand, the magnitude of the capital, on the other, the number of the labouring population. It is, rather, at bottom, only the relation between the unpaid and the paid labour of the same labouring population. If the quantity of unpaid labour supplied by the working class and accumulated by the capitalist class increases so rapidly that its conversion into capital requires an extraordinary addition of paid labour, then wages rise, and, all other circumstances remaining equal, the unpaid labour diminishes in proportion. But as soon as this diminution touches the point at which the surplus labour that nourishes capital is no longer supplied in normal quantity, a reaction sets in. A smaller part of revenue is capitalised, accumulation lags, and the movement of rising wages receives a check. The rise of wages, therefore, is confined within limits that not only leave intact the foundations of the capitalistic system, but also secure its reproduction on a progressive scale. The law of capitalistic accumulation, metamorphosed by economists into pretended law of nature, in reality merely states that the very nature of accumulation excludes every diminution in the degree of exploitation of labour, and every rise in the price of labour, which could seriously imperil the continual reproduction on an ever-enlarging scale of the capitalistic relation. It cannot be otherwise in a mode of production in which the labourer exists to satisfy the needs of self-expansion of existing values, instead of, on the contrary, material wealth existing to satisfy the needs of development on the part of the labourer. As in religion man is governed by the products of his own brain, so in capitalistic production he is governed by the products of his own hand. Footnote. If we now return to our first inquiry, wherein it was shown that capital itself is only the result of human labour, it seems quite incomprehensible that man can have fallen under the domination of capital, his own product, can be subordinated to it, and as in reality this is beyond dispute the case, involuntarily the question arises, how has the labourer been able to pass from being master of capital, as its creator, to being its slave? Von Thunen, Der isolierte Staat. It is Thunen's merit to have asked this question. His answer is simply childish. End of footnote. Section 2. Relative diminution of the variable part of capital simultaneously with the progress of accumulation and of the concentration that accompanies it. According to the economists themselves, it is neither the actual extent of social wealth nor the magnitude of the capital already functioning that lead to a rise of wages, but only the constant growth of accumulation and the degree of rapidity of that growth. Adam Smith, Book 1, Chapter 8. So far, we have only considered one special phase of this process, that in which the increase of capital occurs along with a constant technical composition of capital. But the process goes beyond this phase. Once given the general basis of the capitalistic system, then, in the course of accumulation, a point is reached at which the development of the productivity of social labour becomes the most powerful lever of accumulation. The same cause, says Adam Smith, which raises the wages of labour, the increase of stock, tends to increase its productive powers, and to make a smaller quantity of labour produce a greater quantity of work. Footnote. Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, Volume 1. End of footnote. Apart from natural conditions, such as fertility of the soil, etc., and from the skill of independent and isolated producers, shown rather qualitatively in the goodness than quantitatively in the mass of their products, the degree of productivity of labour in a given society is expressed in the relative extent of the means of production that one labourer during a given time with the same tension of labour power turns into products. The mass of the means of production which he thus transforms increases with the productiveness of his labour. But those means of production play a double part. The increase of some is a consequence, that of the others a condition, of the increasing productivity of labour. For example, with the division of labour in manufacture and with the use of machinery, more raw material is worked up in the same time, and therefore a greater mass of raw material and auxiliary substances enter into the labour process. That is the consequence of the increasing productivity of labour. On the other hand, the mass of machinery, beasts of burden, mineral manures, drain pipes, etc., is a condition of the increasing productivity of labour. So also is it with the means of production concentrated in buildings, furnaces, means of transport, etc. But whether condition or consequence, the growing extent of the means of production, as compared with the labour power incorporated with them, is an expression of the growing productiveness of labour. The increase of the latter appears, therefore, in the diminution of the mass of labour in proportion to the mass of means of production moved by it, or in the diminution of the subjective factor of the labour process as compared with the objective factor. This change in the technical composition of capital, this growth in the mass of means of production, as compared with the mass of the labour power that vivifies them, is reflected again in its value composition by the increase of the constant constituent of capital at the expense of its variable constituent. There may be, for example, originally 50% of a capital laid out in means of production and 50% in labour power. Later on, with the development of the productivity of labour, 80% in means of production, 20% in labour power, and so on. This law of the progressive increase in constant capital in proportion to the variable is confirmed at every step, as already shown, by the comparative analysis of the price of commodities, whether we compare different economic epochs or different nations in the same epoch. The relative magnitude of the element of price, which represents the value of the means of production only, or the constant part of capital consumed, is in direct proportion to the advance of accumulation. The relative magnitude of the other element of price, that pays labour, the variable part of capital, is in inverse proportion to the advance of accumulation. This diminution in the variable part of capital as compared with the constant, or the altered value composition of the capital, however, only shows approximately the change in the composition of its material constituents. If, for example, the capital value employed today in spinning is 7/8 constant and 1/8 variable, whilst at the beginning of the 18th century it was 1/2 constant and 1/2 variable, on the other hand, the mass of raw material, instruments of labour, etc., that a certain quantity of spinning labour consumes productively today is many hundred times greater than at the beginning of the 18th century. The reason is simply that, with the increasing productivity of labour, not only does the mass of the means of production consumed by it increase, but their value compared with their mass diminishes. Their value, therefore, rises absolutely, but not in proportion to their mass. The increase of the difference between constant and variable capital is, therefore, much less than that of the difference between the mass of the means of production into which the constant and the mass of the labour power into which the variable capital is converted. The former difference increases with the latter, but in a smaller degree. But if the progress of accumulation lessens the relative magnitude of the variable part of capital, it by no means, in doing this, excludes the possibility of a rise in its absolute magnitude. Suppose that a capital value at first is divided into 50% of constant and 50% of variable capital, later into 80% of constant and 20% of variable. If, in the meantime, the original capital, say £6,000, has increased to £18,000, its variable constituent has also increased. It was £3,000, it is now £3,600. But whereas formerly an increase of capital by 20% would have sufficed to raise the demand for labour 20%, now this latter rise requires a tripling of the original capital. In Part 4, it was shown how the development of the productiveness of social labour presupposes cooperation on a large scale, how it is only upon this supposition that division and combination of labour can be organised and the means of production economised by concentration on a vast scale, how instruments of labour, which from their very nature are only fit for use in common, such as a system of machinery, can be called into being, how huge natural forces can be pressed into the service of production, and how the transformation can be effected of the process of production into a technological application of science. On the basis of the production of commodities, where the means of production are the property of private persons, and where the artisan therefore either produces commodities isolated from and independent of others, or sells his labour power as a commodity because he lacks the means for independent industry, cooperation on a large scale can realise itself only in the increase of individual capitals, only in proportion as the means of social production and the means of subsistence are transformed into the private property of capitalists. The basis of the production of commodities can admit of production on a large scale in the capitalistic form alone. A certain accumulation of capital in the hands of individual producers of commodities forms, therefore, the necessary preliminary of the specifically capitalistic mode of production. We had, therefore, to assume that this occurs during the transition from handicraft to capitalistic industry. It may be called primitive accumulation, because it is the historic basis, instead of the historic result, of specifically capitalist production. How it itself originates, we need not here inquire as yet. It is enough that it forms the starting point. But all methods for raising the social productive power of labour that are developed on this basis are at the same time methods for the increased production of surplus value, or surplus product, which in its turn is the formative element of accumulation. They are, therefore, at the same time, methods of the production of capital by capital, or methods of its accelerated accumulation. The continual retransformation of surplus value into capital now appears in the shape of the increasing magnitude of the capital that enters into the process of production. This, in turn, is the basis of an extended scale of production, of the methods for raising the productive power of labour that accompany it, and of accelerated production of surplus value. If, therefore, a certain degree of accumulation of capital appears as a condition of the specifically capitalist mode of production, the latter causes, conversely, an accelerated accumulation of capital. With the accumulation of capital, therefore, the specifically capitalistic mode of production develops, and with the capitalist mode of production, the accumulation of capital. Both these economic factors bring about, in the compound ratio of the impulses they reciprocally give one another, that change in the technical composition of capital by which the variable constituent becomes always smaller and smaller, as compared with the constant. Every individual capital is a larger or smaller concentration of means of production, with a corresponding command over a larger or smaller labour army. Every accumulation becomes the means of new accumulation. With the increasing mass of wealth which functions as capital, accumulation increases the concentration of that wealth in the hands of individual capitalists, and thereby widens the basis of production on a large scale and of the specific methods of capitalist production. The growth of social capital is effected by the growth of many individual capitals. All other circumstances remaining the same, individual capitals, and with them the concentration of the means of production, increase in such proportion as they form aliquot parts of the total social capital. At the same time, portions of the original capitals disengage themselves and function as new independent capitals. Besides other causes, the division of property within capitalist families plays a great part in this. With the accumulation of capital, therefore, the number of capitalists grows to a greater or lesser extent. 2 points characterize this kind of concentration which grows directly out of, or rather is identical with, accumulation. First, the increasing concentration of the social means of production in the hands of individual capitalists is, other things remaining equal, limited by the degree of increase of social wealth. Second, the part of social capital domiciled in each particular sphere of production is divided among many capitalists who face one another as independent commodity producers competing with each other. Accumulation and the concentration accompanying it are, therefore, not only scattered over many points, but the increase of each functioning capital is thwarted by the formation of new and the subdivision of old capitals. Accumulation, therefore, presents itself on the one hand as increasing concentration of the means of production and of the command over labour, on the other as repulsion of many individual capitals, one from another. This splitting up of the total social capital into many individual capitals, or the repulsion of its fractions one from another, is counteracted by their attraction. This last does not mean that simple concentration of the means of production and of the command over labour which is identical with accumulation. It is concentration of capitals already formed, destruction of their individual independence, expropriation of capitalist by capitalist, transformation of many small into few large capitals. This process differs from the former in this, that it only presupposes a change in the distribution of capital already to hand and functioning. Its field of action is therefore not limited by the absolute growth of social wealth, by the absolute limits of accumulation. Capital grows in one place to a huge mass in a single hand, because it has in another place been lost by many. This is centralization proper, as distinct from accumulation and concentration. The laws of this centralization of capitals, or of the attraction of capital by capital, cannot be developed here. A brief hint at a few facts must suffice. The battle of competition is fought by cheapening of commodities. The cheapness of commodities demands, ceteris paribus, on the productiveness of labour, and this again on the scale of production. Therefore, the larger capitals beat the smaller. It will further be remembered that, with the development of the capitalist mode of production, there is an increase in the minimum amount of individual capital necessary to carry on a business under its normal conditions. The smaller capitals, therefore, crowd into spheres of production which modern industry has only sporadically or incompletely got hold of. Here, competition rages in direct proportion to the number and in inverse proportion to the magnitudes of the antagonistic capitals. It always ends in the ruin of many small capitalists, whose capitals partly pass into the hands of their conquerors, partly vanish. Apart from this, with capitalist production, an altogether new force comes into play, the credit system, which in its first stages furtively creeps in as the humble assistant of accumulation, drawing into the hands of individual or associated capitalists by invisible threads the money resources which lie scattered over the surface of society in larger or smaller amounts. But it soon becomes a new and terrible weapon in the battle of competition, and is finally transformed into an enormous social mechanism for the centralization of capitals. Commensurately with the development of capitalist production and accumulation, there developed the two most powerful levers of centralization, competition and credit. At the same time, the progress of accumulation increases the material amenable to centralization, that is, the individual capitals, whilst the expansion of capitalist production creates, on the one hand, the social want, and on the other the technical means necessary for those immense industrial undertakings which require a previous centralization of capital for their accomplishment. Today, therefore, the force of attraction, drawing together individual capitals, and the tendency to centralization are stronger than ever before. But if the relative extension and energy of the movement towards centralization is determined in a certain degree by the magnitude of capitalist wealth and superiority of economic mechanism already attained, progress in centralization does not in any way depend upon a positive growth in the magnitude of social capital. And this is the specific difference between centralization and concentration, the latter being only another name for reproduction on an extended scale. Centralization may result from a mere change in the distribution of capitals already existing, from a simple alteration in the quantitative grouping of the component parts of social capital. Here, capital can grow into powerful masses in a single hand, because there it has been withdrawn from many individual hands. In any given branch of industry, centralization would reach its extreme limit if all the individual capitals invested in it were fused into a single capital. Footnote. Note in the fourth German edition, the latest English and American trusts are already striving to attain this goal by attempting to unite at least all the large-scale concerns in one branch of industry into one great joint stock company with a practical monopoly. Friedrich Engels, end of footnote. In a given society, the limit would be reached only when the entire social capital was united in the hands of either a single capitalist or a single capitalist company. Centralization completes the work of accumulation by enabling industrial capitalists to extend the scale of their operations. Whether this latter result is the consequence of accumulation or centralization, whether centralization is accomplished by the violent method of annexation, when certain capitals become such preponderant centers of attraction for others that they shatter the individual cohesion of the latter and then draw the separate fragments to themselves, or whether the fusion of a number of capitals already formed or in process of formation takes place by the smoother process of organizing joint stock companies, the economic effect remains the same. Everywhere, the increased scale of industrial establishments is the starting point for a more comprehensive organization of the collective work of many, for a wider development of their material motive forces. In other words, for the progressive transformation of isolated processes of production carried on by customary methods into processes of production socially combined and scientifically arranged. But accumulation, the gradual increase of capital by reproduction as it passes from the circular to the spiral form, is clearly a very slow procedure compared with centralization, which has only to change the quantitative groupings of the constituent parts of social capital. The world would still be without railways if it had had to wait until accumulation had got a few individual capitals far enough to be adequate for the construction of a railway. Centralization, on the contrary, accomplished this in the twinkling of an eye by means of joint stock companies. And whilst centralization thus intensifies and accelerates the effects of accumulation, it simultaneously extends and speeds those revolutions in the technical composition of capital which raise its constant portion at the expense of its variable portion, thus diminishing the relative demand for labour. The masses of capital fused together overnight by centralization reproduce and multiply as the others do, only more rapidly, thereby becoming new and powerful levers in social accumulation. Therefore, when we speak of the progress of social accumulation, we tacitly include, today, the effects of centralization. The additional capitals formed in the normal course of accumulation, see Chapter 24, Section 1, serve particularly as vehicles for the exploitation of new inventions and discoveries, and industrial improvements in general. But in time, the old capital also reaches the moment of renewal from top to toe, when it sheds its skin and is reborn, like the others, in a perfected technical form, in which a smaller quantity of labour will suffice to set in motion a larger quantity of machinery and raw materials. The absolute reduction in the demand for labour which necessarily follows from this is obviously so much the greater, the higher the degree in which the capitals undergoing this process of renewal are already massed together by virtue of the centralization movement. On the one hand, therefore, the additional capital formed in the course of accumulation attracts fewer and fewer labourers in proportion to its magnitude. On the other hand, the old capital, periodically reproduced with change of composition, repels more and more of the labourers formerly employed by it. Section 3. Progressive production of a relative surplus population, or industrial reserve army. The accumulation of capital, though originally appearing as its quantitative extension only, is effected, as we have seen, under a progressive qualitative change in its composition, under a constant increase of its constant at the expense of its variable constituent. Footnote. Note in the third German edition. In Marx's copy, there is here the marginal note, here note for working out later. If the extension is only quantitative, then for a greater and a smaller capital in the same branch of business, the profits are as the magnitudes of the capitals advanced. If the quantitative extension induces qualitative change, then the rate of profit on the larger capital rises simultaneously. Friedrich Engels, end of footnote. The specifically capitalist mode of production, the development of the productive power of labour corresponding to it, and the change thence resulting in the organic composition of capital, do not merely keep pace with the advance of accumulation or with the growth of social wealth. They develop at a much quicker rate, because mere accumulation, the absolute increase of the total social capital, is accompanied by the centralization of the individual capitals of which that total is made up. And because the change in the technological composition of the additional capital goes hand in hand with a similar change in the technological composition of the original capital. With the advance of accumulation, therefore, the proportion of constant to variable capital changes. If it was originally, say, 1:1, it now becomes successively 2:1, 3:1, 4:1, 5:1, 7:1, etc., so that, as the capital increases, instead of half of its total value, only 1/3, 1/4, 1/5, 1/6, 1/8, etc., is transformed into labour power, and on the other hand, 2/3, 3/4, 4/5, 5/6, 7/8, into means of production. Since the demand for labour is determined not by the amount of capital as a whole, but by its variable constituent alone, that demand falls progressively with the increase of the total capital, instead of, as previously assumed, rising in proportion to it. It falls relatively to the magnitude of the total capital, and at an accelerated rate, as this magnitude increases. With the growth of the total capital, its variable constituent, or the labour incorporated in it, also does increase, but in a constantly diminishing proportion. The intermediate pauses are shortened in which accumulation works as a simple extension of production on a given technical basis. It is not merely that an accelerated accumulation of total capital, accelerated in a constantly growing progression, is needed to absorb an additional number of labourers, or even, on account of the constant metamorphosis of old capital, to keep employed those already functioning. In its turn, this increasing accumulation and centralization becomes a source of new changes in the composition of capital, of a more accelerated diminution of its variable as compared with its constant constituent. This accelerated relative diminution of the variable constituent that goes along with the accelerated increase of the total capital and moves more rapidly than this increase takes the inverse form at the other pole of an apparently absolute increase of the labouring population, an increase always moving more rapidly than that of the variable capital or the means of employment. But in fact, it is capitalistic accumulation itself that constantly produces, and produces in the direct ratio of its own energy and extent, a relatively redundant population of labourers, that is, a population of greater extent than suffices for the average needs of the self-expansion of capital, and therefore a surplus population. Considering the social capital in its totality, the movement of its accumulation now causes periodical changes affecting it more or less as a whole, now distributes its various phases simultaneously over the different spheres of production. In some spheres, a change in the composition of capital occurs without increase of its absolute magnitude, as a consequence of simple centralization. In others, the absolute growth of capital is connected with absolute diminution of its variable constituent, or of the labour power absorbed by it. In others again, capital continues growing for a time on its given technical basis and attracts additional labour power in proportion to its increase, while at other times it undergoes organic change and lessens its variable constituent. In all spheres, the increase of the variable part of capital, and therefore of the number of labourers employed by it, is always connected with violent fluctuations and transitory production of surplus population, whether this takes the more striking form of the repulsion of labourers already employed, or the less evident but not less real form of the more difficult absorption of the additional labouring population through the usual channels. With the magnitude of social capital already functioning and the degree of its increase, with the extension of the scale of production and the mass of the labourers set in motion, with the development of the productiveness of their labour, with the greater breadth and fullness of all sources of wealth, there is also an extension of the scale on which greater attraction of labourers by capital is accompanied by their greater repulsion. The rapidity of the change in the organic composition of capital and in its technical form increases, and an increasing number of spheres of production becomes involved in this change, now simultaneously, now alternately. The labouring population therefore produces, along with the accumulation of capital produced by it, the means by which it itself is made relatively superfluous, is turned into a relative surplus population, and it does this to an always increasing extent. This is a law of population peculiar to the capitalist mode of production, and in fact every special historic mode of production has its own special laws of population, historically valid within its limits, and only in so far as man has not interfered with them. Footnote. Added in the 4th German edition. The law of progressive diminution of the relative magnitude of variable capital and its effect on the condition of the class of wage workers is conjectured rather than understood by some of the prominent economists of the classical school. The greatest service was rendered here by John Barton, although he, like all the rest, lumps together constant and fixed capital, variable and circulating capital. He says, "The demand for labour depends on the increase of circulating and not of fixed capital. Were it true that the proportion between these two sorts of capital is the same at all times and in all circumstances, then indeed it follows that the number of labourers employed is in proportion to the wealth of the state. But such a proposition has not the semblance of probability. As arts are cultivated and civilization is extended, fixed capital bears a larger and larger proportion to circulating capital. The amount of fixed capital employed in the production of a piece of British muslin is at least 100, probably 1,000 times greater than that employed in a similar piece of Indian muslin. And the proportion of circulating capital is 100 or 1,000 times less. The whole of the annual savings, added to the fixed capital, would have no effect in increasing the demand for labour. John Barton, Observations on the Circumstances Which Influence the Condition of the Labouring Classes of Society, London, 1817. The same cause which may increase the net revenue of the country may at the same time render the population redundant and deteriorate the condition of the labourer. Ricardo. With increase of capital, the demand for labour will be in a diminishing ratio. Ibidem. The amount of capital devoted to the maintenance of labour may vary independently of any changes in the whole amount of capital. Great fluctuations in the amount of employment and great suffering may become more frequent as capital itself becomes more plentiful. Richard Jones, An Introductory Lecture on Political Economy, London, 1833. Demand for labour will rise not in proportion to the accumulation of the general capital. Every augmentation, therefore, in the national stock destined for reproduction comes, in the progress of society, to have less and less influence upon the condition of the labourer. Ramsay. End of footnote. But if a surplus labouring population is a necessary product of accumulation or of the development of wealth on a capitalist basis, this surplus population becomes, conversely, the lever of capitalistic accumulation, nay, a condition of existence of the capitalist mode of production. It forms a disposable industrial reserve army that belongs to capital quite as absolutely as if the latter had bred it at its own cost. Independently of the limits of the actual increase of population, it creates, for the changing needs of the self-expansion of capital, a mass of human material always ready for exploitation. With accumulation and the development of the productiveness of labour that accompanies it, the power of sudden expansion of capital grows also. It grows not merely because the elasticity of the capital already functioning increases, not merely because the absolute wealth of society expands, of which capital only forms an elastic part, not merely because credit, under every special stimulus, at once places an unusual part of this wealth at the disposal of production in the form of additional capital, it grows also because the technical conditions of the process of production themselves, machinery, means of transport, etc., now admit of the rapidest transformation of masses of surplus product into additional means of production. The mass of social wealth, overflowing with the advance of accumulation and transformable into additional capital, thrusts itself frantically into old branches of production, whose market suddenly expands, or into newly formed branches, such as railways, etc., the need for which grows out of the development of the old ones. In all such cases, there must be the possibility of throwing great masses of men suddenly on the decisive points, without injury to the scale of production in other spheres. Overpopulation supplies these masses. The course characteristic of modern industry, viz. A decennial cycle interrupted by smaller oscillations, of periods of average activity, production at high pressure, crisis and stagnation, depends on the constant formation, the greater or less absorption, and the reformation of the industrial reserve army or surplus population. In their turn, the varying phases of the industrial cycle recruit the surplus population and become one of the most energetic agents of its reproduction. This peculiar course of modern industry, which occurs in no earlier period of human history, was also impossible in the childhood of capitalist production. The composition of capital changed, but very slowly. With its accumulation, therefore, there kept pace, on the whole, a corresponding growth in the demand for labour. Slow as was the advance of accumulation compared with that of more modern times, it found a check in the natural limits of the exploitable labouring population, limits which could only be got rid of by forcible means, to be mentioned later. The expansion by fits and starts of the scale of production